Okay, so welcome back everybody to Interventional Medical Image Processing. We started talking a bit about different pre-processing algorithms, and what we wanted to aim at are algorithms that are fast in particular. And so far we have seen that we can cut down on the complexity of algorithms and then end up with several algorithms that have the ability to be executed very fast. Later, we also want to interpret images, and in order to interpret images, we will make use of low-level descriptors that we then can compose to different structures and extract information from the image. So later, we may want to detect certain features of the image, and often what we do is we do some kind of processing to simplify the information extraction. One thing that will be very important are edges, so edges and gradients. And edges and gradients are very useful in order to detect important points in an image, and we will talk today about something which is called the structure tensor and why the structure tensor is interesting to extract features from an image. So, why are edges and gradients interesting? Well, if you think about an image, you are most of the time, or the points that will pop up in your eye immediately are changes in intensity. So if you, for example, think of a slice image, what you will note is that if you have some kind of, let's say you have a slice of a patient. Don't I have a, I have an example here. So let's say you have a slice of a patient image. So this is a CT slice, and this one is contrast enhanced. You will see that you have homogeneous areas in the image. So there's homogeneous areas like here, and then there are certain changes in intensity. And these changes in intensity are in particular interesting. And on the right-hand side, you see the gradient image. So the gradient image, and here the gradient norm is denoted in color, shows you the important features of the image. So you can see that, for example, the table here appears very bright, and furthermore, the outline of the patient. So at the boundary of the patient, you have a strong change in gradient. So there is a change in the intensity, and this pops up in the gradient image. So the gradient image is related to edges. And edges are interesting because, let's say you want, for example, detect the outline of an organ, so you want to determine the surface of the liver or something like this, and then you can see that the organ has an edge, an intensity edge surrounding, and you can use this edge information to determine the outline. Also here, you can see that the different organs, they are outlined by edges. Okay, then what can we further see? There's a very strong edge from air to the patient, because the patient is composed mostly of water, so soft tissues, and you have a strong edge from air to soft tissue, and there's also a very strong edge again here. Why do we have the strong edge here? Can you imagine? Yes? Well, this appears dark in this image. So what could be here? There's another strong edge here. Can you see the strong edge here, down here? What's this?
That's a bone.
Yeah, so this is part of the spine bone. Yeah, and the bone is much denser than the soft tissue, so you have a very strong edge here. But here you also have a very strong edge. And yeah, it's air in the colon, exactly. So we have strong edges in this image between air and soft tissue, and again we have an edge between air and soft tissue here, so this is not a bone, but so the height of this edge here is approximately the same as in the area down here. You can see that, because so in the gradient image we see the edge. But here, this is the norm of the gradient, so it doesn't tell us the direction of the gradient. because we're only looking at the length of the gradient vector. And therefore, we cannot differentiate anymore between the interface between air and soft tissue or between soft tissue and bone. They appear very similar in this image. So you also need to think about what is actually shown in this image that you can understand the kind of information that is displayed. So this is not a patient that has two spines, but he has just has some air in the colon. Okay, good. So what do we have to understand about the gradient? Well, in images we have two or three dimensions, and in general the gradient is the derivative with respect to the different orientations. So here in the example in equation one, we have a 2D gradient because we also have 2D images in the following. And here is the derivative of the image with respect to x and the derivative of the image with respect to y. And in the following, we will call this fx and fy, so component-wise. And now the other image that I showed on the, actually on the next slide, was showing the gradient norm. So the gradient is generally a vector quantity because it has an orientation and a strength. And if we want to display a vector quantity in a single image, we have different ways of reducing this in order to show it. So one way would be to show the orientation. So we show the color-coded angle of the gradient, or we can look at the norm, then we have the strength of the gradient, or we can also do a component-wise visualization. So we could only look at fx and fy here. So this would also be, because these are the two components of the vector, they would also be an entire image, those two components. Generally, we have certain trade-off that we have to deal with in generally in CT images or also in other imaging modalities. You can have, for example, in CT, you will end up with very noisy images if you try to achieve a low patient dose. So if you go down with the dose, the number of x-rays that you irradiate the patient with, you will end up with a higher noise level. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind is the diagnostic task. So if you're interested in a very low contrast, so in a very little jump in terms of intensity, then you need to achieve a very good low contrast visibility. And there it will be hard to see the low contrasts if you have a lot of noise. So if you're looking for an intensity difference, and let's say the kind of difference that you're looking at is 10 Hounsfield units, so the kind of function, the difference that you're looking at is this, but then the signal is overlaid with a noise of, let's say, 30 Hounsfield units, then you end up with something like this, and then you have maybe a function like this. So in this kind of function, it will be very difficult to see your 10 Hounsfield units difference. And generally, your noise is of very high frequency. And so this is the other point. If you now run edge detection on this one here, then you will detect a lot of edges because the noise will cause a lot of edges. So now the thing is, can we do some processing techniques in order to help us with the image interpretation? And one thing that you may see here already is typically those low contrasts that you're looking for, they don't change from pixel to pixel. Typically they have a low spatial frequency, so they have some certain extent. And you can use that in order to suppress the noise, and you can always suppress image noise by smoothing, by blurring, but this also means that the image resolution goes down. But sometimes you can sacrifice resolution in order to improve the noise contrast, the contrast to noise level. Okay, good. So how do we do now this? How do we calculate those gradients? So if our image would be a continuous function, then we could compute the derivative with respect to the two orientations, and we had our gradient. But typically, our images are discrete. So we need some kind of discrete approximation of the gradient. And So what we want to do is we want to detect those high frequency, those high changes in intensities, and we want to compute this discrete gradient somehow from this image. A couple of general remarks is the edge that when we talk about gradients and edges. So the edge is typically a structure in the image that has a set of oriented gradients, and those gradients point into an orthogonal direction with respect to the edge. And well, this is not really true, but you can see that in the exercises. But it's a pretty good first assumption. What we'll also see is that the derivatives are highly sensitive to noise, and this is also something that you can see here. Here we have a lot of change in intensity, so if you compute derivatives from this one here, you will end up with a lot of edges, but the edge that you want to detect is probably the one that is overlaid here, so we need to learn some tricks how to do that. And there's tons of different discretizations. So one way to think about discrete derivatives is you could start with a Taylor series expansion. So what you do is you have the position, so you have your signal, and now we stay in 1D, and the signal is is generally f, and now you want to compute the signal at the position f plus h. So h is a small change in your coordinates, so you go a small step ahead. And now you want to approximate your signal at the position x plus h, and you start at the point f of x. And what you do is you go into the direction of the derivative with and you do a step with h, with size h, into the direction of the derivative. And then the missing component is essentially of the degree 2 or higher. Now, if we just neglect this part here, even if we don't neglect this part here, we can rewrite this in order to compute the derivative. And what we do now is we solve equation 2 with respect to our derivative f prime of x. And now we get the solution for f prime of x. Well, you have to bring essentially this part over and then divide by h. And then you will see that the derivative can be estimated by f of x plus h minus f of x divided by h. And then we still neglect something which is of the order of at least second order. Now, if we neglect this part entirely, you can see that we can find different solutions for the approximation of the derivative if we decide for different values of h. Now, we are in a discrete system, so we don't have that many options for h. So h needs to be a discrete step size. So we can only work in pixels. We cannot work with half pixels, and we cannot work with 10% pixels. We have to remain in the step size of the discrete system. So if we want to have a small step size, because this will only be valid for small step sizes, then we more or less only have the options that we can decide for h equals to 1 or h equals to minus 1. And now if we plug that in, we get very straightforward, two discrete versions of a derivative, which is essentially the forward and the backward difference. So we take the point x plus 1 and subtract f of x, or we take the point f of x and subtract f of x minus 1. So these are the two solutions that we find for discrete derivatives. This is generally interesting because derivatives also have the... So this is a discrete first solution for discrete derivative. And how would you now apply this? How would you compute the actual derivative? So in order to compute the derivative at... So let's do a 1D image, right? Okay, so this is our 1D image. And now we put in the value 5, 7, 8, 6, and 10. Okay. And now we want to compute the derivative at this point. How do we do that? Well, well, you could use central differences, but you could just do the forward difference here. Well, let's just apply equation 4. So equation 4 says that we take f of x plus 1, which would be 8, and then we take 8 and we subtract f of x. And f of x is 7. So we get 1. Now I already neglected one thing. So I did not compute it at the very first position, because then I have to think about boundary conditions. One way, because I essentially need to use a mask. And this mask says we want to compute at, sorry, this is a forward difference. So no, this is perfectly fine. Okay. So we can do that. We can do 5 and subtract 7, right? This is what we want. No, we'd want to take 7 and subtract 5. Okay. So this is going to be 2, yeah? Okay, so this is perfectly fine. So we do 1 here and minus 1 here. This is the prefactor, and then we shift ahead. And so this gave us 1, and then we can advance to the next position. So we take 6 and subtract 8. So this is going to be minus 2, okay? You see what I'm doing? And then I go to the next position, and I take minus 6 plus 10. So this is going to be 4. And now we end up at a problem. So now we want to compute minus 1, 1 at this point. And now we're at the boundary of the image. And here we need some kind of boundary conditions. And one way to solve the boundary problem is just to have a constant extrapolation. So you could just continue only with tens, and in this direction only with fives. So this would be a constant extrapolation. Or you could wrap. So you could say the image starts over here, then you have a cyclic system. Yeah? But in this case, we just do constant extrapolation, and if we compute that, we just get 0. So this will lead to a 0 gradient at the image boundary, if you do constant extrapolation. Okay, have you seen this process before, that you take this kind of mask and shift it through through a sequence? How is this generally called? This is, yes? Yes, it's a convolution. So when we do this, we have just derived a way of computing a discrete derivative, and now we have applied it, and we found out experimentally this is a convolution. And when it is a convolution, then there is also the convolution theorem. Do you remember what the convolution theorem says? Yes, the convolution in spatial domain is a multiplication in frequency domain. So this is very interesting. If you compute a derivative, you're doing convolution. So if you do something like d of f of x with respect to x, you compute the derivative, this is equivalent to a convolution. So this is a convolution, we just know that. And this is equivalent to a multiplication in Fourier space. And if you have the Fourier transform, so you call this capital F of omega, then this is just the multiplication with 2 pi omega I. So this would be both of this, of course, is continuous, yeah? So we're not discrete in this case. But this is a way of computing also a derivative. So computing derivatives is a convolution. And this is now nice, because if you have image operators, many image operators actually are convolutions. And now you can combine different image operators. So because what you probably know is smoothing. So smoothing is also a convolution. Smoothing is when you convolve with a Gaussian. So if you a box filter or a Gaussian, you end up with smoothing. And this derivative is also just a convolution. And because it's a convolution, you are able to combine it with other imaging operations. Another very nice thing is when we talk about combination of operators, by the way, is if you do multiple convolutions after each other, then you can also combine this in single steps. Or maybe this is even a good idea in a certain processing steps to only do partial convolutions. So what happens if you convolve an image with a Gaussian? We just said that. It's moving. And what happens if I smooth again with the same Gaussian? Yeah, you smooth more. And do you know how you can describe this effect? What happens if you have multiple applications of the same Gaussian filter? So this is generally called cascading. And sometimes it's more efficient to, if you have, we will see that later. Later we want to build resolution hierarchies, and there we want to apply pretty large kernels, but also very small kernels. And then you end up with different versions of the same image in different resolutions. And one way to do that is use cascading. And what we essentially want to do is we want to convolve with a Gaussian. So with the generally, you can describe a Gaussian as 1 over, in the 1D case, sigma square root over 2 pi times e to the power of minus, and now we just use a Gaussian with a Gaussian that is just centered to the origin. So this is only bx squared, so it has a zero mean value, and then divided over 2 sigma squared. If I apply this to the image, I'm convolving with this guy, and now I want to convolve with the same function again. So I want to convolve this with the same function. So I want to apply the same Gaussian 2 times after each other. And this is going to be sigma 2 pi square root e to the power of minus x square 2 sigma square. So now we would have to really implement this convolution and do all the math, but we remember the convolution theorem, and there this convolution will only boil down to a multiplication. Who knows the Fourier transform of a Gaussian? It's again a Gaussian with an inverse variance. So if you convert this to frequency space, you will end up with 1 over 2 pi square root e to the power of minus and then sigma square, and now we need omega square over 2. Okay? And now we do the same here. So this is going to be 1 over 2 pi square root e to the power of minus sigma square omega square divided over 2. And what can we see here? So if we multiply the two, you will end up with, this needs to be multiplied. So you will have 1 over 2 pi. And because this is exponential functions, if I multiply exponential functions, what happens? You can add the exponents. So we will end up with minus sigma square omega square over 2 minus omega square sigma square omega square over 2. And now you can see that I can actually pull out the the sigma. And in this case, we just end up with, let's rewrite this to 1 over 2 pi e to the power of minus. And now we want to bring it again into a notation. So sigma square plus sigma square, or 2 sigma square. So this is going to be just 2 sigma square. And then divided over 2 omega, okay, square. And now you need to convert back. So you need to convert back into our spatial domain. And you will see that we just can show that this will be in spatial domain. So this is probably easier to write this as square root 2 sigma to the power of 2, okay? So we put it into our square root, and you will see that we then just can go back into our frequency space, and we will see that we have essentially square root 2 sigma times the square root e to the power of minus x square, and this is going to be 2 square root 2 sigma square sigma to the power of 2. Okay, like this. So essentially, if I convolve with the Gaussian, I'm expanding the standard deviation of a square root of 2. Yeah, because I need to go back to standard deviations. Yeah? So what happens to the standard deviation? The standard deviation is going to be increased by a factor of square root 2. Okay, so we see that this whole thing with frequency space is very nice, because then we can very easily see the effects of different convolutions after each other. And you can see that if we cascade Gaussians, we are essentially increasing the standard deviation by a square root of 2. Okay. Very well. So this is interesting. We can now see that image filters are, that we can compose image filters as convolutions, and that we can combine different image filters to get new image operations, and we can summarize them in a single image filter. So one way in order to get very robust estimation of edges is combined smoothing and computing the derivative. So you can do a combined low-pass filtering with a combined derivative, and there's also many different options of doing this. For example, you can just do a 2D convolution and then compute the derivative. So this would be a kind of scale-space approach, where you first reduce the resolution of the image, and then you compute the derivative. And this will essentially boil down to first blurring the image and then compute the derivatives. And you can say, for example, cases like above here. So if I first apply a smoothing on this function above there, I will be able to reduce the noise. And after I've reduced the noise, I'm still able to compute a derivative. But they will be pretty broad. But this is one way how I can keep up with the noise. But generally, I will only be able to get very low frequency, very low spatial frequencies from this. One very popular way, for example, of computing the rather stable derivatives is applying the smoothing in one direction and the derivative into the other direction. So if you think of convolution masks, you can approximate a Gaussian function with the mask 1, 2, 1. So this is, if you have this kind of convolution mask, this is approximately a Gaussian. So if you think about the Gaussian function, it's going to look like this. So this is going to be 2, this is going to be 1, this is going to be 1. It's clearly a Gaussian. Absolutely. Yeah. And now you can combine this with a derivative operation, but just in the other direction. So you end up with a 2D filtering mask, and the 2D filtering mask now looks this way. So now we do a central difference. The mask for the central difference would be minus 1, 0, 1. And we have 1, 2, and 1 in the other direction. So we do smoothing in the y direction, and we compute the derivative with respect to x. And then you end up with something which looks like minus 1, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 0, 0, and 1, 2, 1. And you can also do this for the other direction. So this is a combined smoothing and derivative operation. And the trick is that you apply the smoothing into the other direction in order not to lose so much resolution. Or you can also combine this directly in the same direction. So you can also compute smoothing in x while having a derivative in x. And you can do the trick. You can look at that and compute it. By the way, one thing, if you think about our discrete solution with minus 1 and 1 for the derivative, if you think about the derivative of this guy, then you see, so here we have a positive slope. So we would have some kind of positive function. So we have an accelerating slope. Then we have a stable point here. So at this point, the derivative has to be 0. And here we suddenly have a negative slope. Yeah? So a kind of function like this would be a derivative of the Gaussian. And now you can think about, if you think about the discretization, so one way of discretizing this is to take this value and this value. Yeah, then we only discretize at these two points. And you would have essentially minus 1 and 1, but just flipped. Yeah. Just be careful with the direction. But this would be one discretization of the derivative of this. So depending on your pixel size, this what we essentially do with our discrete version of the derivative is we apply a smoothing in such a way that we are in the pixel size, and then we compute our derivative. Or if you do a central difference, so if you have this minus 1, 0, 1, then you are discretizing this function at this point, and at this point. So this is the central difference. So this is where the 0 comes in. Okay, and of course, now what happens if you combine a convolution in the same direction? Then you increase the standard deviation. And if you increase the standard deviation, you will also increase the width of this function. So if you further smooth this function, you end up with derivatives that will probably look like this. So you increase the footprint. Previously, we had a footprint like this, so you increase the footprint, and then you can come up with different discretizations here. Yeah? So this would also be a kind of derivative combined with a smoothing, and it would look like this. Okay? This is just to get a bit of feeling. If you think about convolutions and about the image processing, you can think about the about the actual impulse response and the effect of different operations on these impulse responses in order to see how the operations will then look like. Good. Generally, as a rule of thumb, this is quite important down here. What you can do is, or what you think about is, if you compute derivatives and if you combine functions, it's a good idea to stay in continuous domain for a long time and then discretize in the end. So you first do, if you design kernels, then what you probably want to do is you want to stay in continuous domain and just discretize at the very end. Because if you stay in the discrete domain, you can see that I have a very limited amount of options that I can actually do. There's only discrete options of how I can combine this. But if I want to have a smoothing by a factor of 2.5, I will have trouble doing this, designing this in the discrete domain. So then I can stay in the continuous domain and discretize at the very end. And then I have just a single kernel, a single convolution, and I'm done. Okay. Now let's go to a concept that is called structure tensor. And structure tensor is something which is very useful because it allows you to interpret structures in an image. So this is a very nice thing. This has first been introduced by Förstner Gülch in 1987. And this is useful for edge detection, corner detection, texture analysis, optical flow tracking, and has many different applications. But the fundamental idea is to get some low-level descriptors of the image that allow you some interpretation of a local neighborhood. And what you do is you are thinking about the tensor product of gradients. And in fact, what you're doing is not just, well, the general idea is just the tensor product of a single gradient, but what you actually want to do is you want to look at a couple of gradients. And if you do that, what you are able to do is you can summarize the gradients in an area. So let's say you have an image and you have gradients in that image, and those images, so what happens if we have gradients, for example, they point into this direction, and now this is an edge, yeah? So this is the edge, so the gradients point in this direction at the edge, and then we have homogeneous areas where we just have zero gradients, so there will be no gradient. What we will have now is we have essentially, we can take those gradients and put them all onto the same point. And if we have an edge, all of those gradients will, let's say there's a bit of noise, but they will more or less all point into this direction. Now what I can do is, I can do, let's fill this up with the gradients into the opposite direction as well. But what I can do is, I can now do an analysis of the orientation of the gradients. So what I do is I do an eigenvalue decomposition, and then I analyze the shape of this ellipse. And if I have an ellipse here that has a very, let's say this has only one rank, then I will have gradients in this area that are very uniform. And if I have gradients that are not uniform, let's say we have a corner. So let's say we have a corner, then the gradients at the corner, so this is our corner, so the gradient here will point in this direction, the gradient here will point in this direction, no gradients here, no gradients here. And if I move them, so I'm taking the arrows and move them here to the center, I will get gradients pointing into this and this direction, and now if I complete with the opposite direction, I will get with something which has a spread like this. So this has, well, this one has probably only one eigenvalue. The distribution that I have here will have two eigenvalues, two large non-zero eigenvalues. So in this case, I will probably have a lambda 1 that is greater than 0 and a lambda 2, if I orient them, lambda 2 will be 0. So I always have the larger eigenvalue described as lambda 1. And here I will have the case lambda 1 and lambda 2. They are both greater than 0, and they should be significantly greater than 0. Well, and if I have the flat case, my gradients will just all be 0. And here I have this, so this falls down to the very center. And here I will have the case lambda 1 equals lambda 2 equals 0. Okay? So the structure tensor is one way of accumulating gradients, writing them into a matrix, and then do an eigenvalue analysis of this matrix. And the eigenvalues now tell us something about the local structure in the neighborhood. Generally, the formulation up here is only for a single pixel. So at a very at a single pixel, you take the gradient with respect to x and with respect to y, and you do an outer product with xy with the gradient to itself, and you end up with this matrix. Now, what happens if I multiply the same vector with itself? What rank does the matrix have? 1. Yes, if you multiply a vector with itself, you get a rank of matrix 1. So if you just implement this by the book, and it tells you to take this vector and multiply it with this vector and do eigenvalue analysis of this matrix, you will get only a single eigenvalue. So what you need to do is you need to apply relaxation. And relaxation will now include a neighborhood. So for every pixel, you compute the derivative with respect to x and multiply it with itself. You compute the derivative with respect to y and multiply it with itself. And then you compute the derivative with x and y and multiply the two. And this will be, so in this way, you will be able to compute such a matrix for every point, for every pixel. And you can summarize this matrix essentially in three images, because this matrix has three components. It has the combined component fxy, it has the component fx square, and the component fy square. So you have essentially three channels in this new image. And every of these channels, so only the fx square component and only the fxy component, you apply local smoothing. So what you do is you interpret every entry of this matrix as an image on its own, and within this channel, you apply a smoothing. Yeah? So you're not applying a smoothing within this matrix, but for every component of this matrix, every component is again an image. You can think back to the case with the gradient, where we had essentially two components, and here we now have three components. And now you apply a smoothing with respect to the particular channel. And of course, you can also apply a smoothing within within the gradient. So you can also apply a general smoothing, which is denoted here by sigma. But you can also convolve within that certain component. And this effect that you do a smoothing within only a single component is called relaxation. And because you apply this relaxation, you will end up with matrices, you will end up with a matrix that has no longer a rank 1. But it only works if you apply this kind of relaxation. So this relaxation or regularization, you apply, and then you do eigenvalue analysis of this matrix. And as we already said, we will get two eigenvalues. And if the two eigenvalues are 0, you have a flat area. And if you have an edge, you will have one strong eigenvalue, because there will be one dominant orientation of the gradients. So this is an edge. Yeah? So there's only one dominant gradient orientation. If you have a corner or a single point, you will end up with gradients in all orientations. So you will have two large eigenvalues. And this is the corner case, where you have lambda 1. And because the eigenvalues are ordered, and lambda 1 is always bigger than lambda 2, then you will end up with this constellation, greater or equal. Okay, and now this is very cool, because dependent on the amount of spatial smoothing that I apply, I can adjust the resolution of my detection. So if I apply very little spatial smoothing, then I will have a detector that is sensitive to very small structures. And if I apply a lot of smoothing, I will have a detector that will only react to very big structures. And yeah, this general remark that you need the averaging, so you need the relaxation, and of course this structure tensor is positive semi-definite, it's symmetric, and the eigenvectors and eigenvalues allow the classification of the structures. So here's an example, and here we have different modes of relaxation. So we have, first of all, no relaxation at all. This is the input image, so this is a fingerprint image. And now I apply a little relaxation, and you can see, by the way, color coding displays the orientation. So now the color doesn't say the norm, but it shows the orientation, the dominant orientation of the eigenvector. So we color code it by color. And now you will see that if I apply only little regularization, this kind of vector orientation will be very noisy, and I can see that this image still holds a lot of the very small edge information. You can see this kind of vortex structure still in the image. And if you apply more regularization, you will see that it will be much smoother, and you will have more uniform orientation estimates. And if you blow this up to 26, then you can see you get a very, very smooth gradient orientation. So you get a detector for rather large structures. And this is now the vortex that is formed by the fingerprint. You see this curling structure, and you are able to identify this change of orientation in the global edges. So this is a summary of the structure in this area, and generally the edges in this whole area point towards this direction. And if you go to this point, to the point where the turn is, so this is here, and here you have a lot of change in the local structure, and you are able to see this in this kind of image. Okay, so structure tensor is a pretty nice method. And with structure tensors, we are able to differentiate corners, we are able to differentiate edges, and we can identify flat areas. Some drawbacks. Well, the computation of the structure tensor, you have this, yes?
Sorry, I have a question. I didn't get, do we just sum over the structures, tensors, to smooth them, or do we do a weighted sum?
So you do a Gaussian smoothing, and this is a kind of weighted sum.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could also choose for a box filter for the smoothing. Then you would have just a sum of the different structure tensors. And this is not the only way of designing a structure tensor. You can also play with the number of orientations. So this has only two orientations, but you can also think about sampling in more orientations. So there's different ways of composing structure tensors. We are only talking about a very small amount of this, but there's a lot of works out there playing with the parameters and the form and how to interpret the structure tensors. Of course, you can also go to 3D, and then you end up with three eigenvalues, and then you get surflets, tubular structures, and you can also get like 1D. No, you can get surfaces, then you can get corners, and then you can get essentially a tip, which has truly and free orientations. Yes.
When we have our smooth structure tensor, how do we get back to the gradient image?
Well, you're not going back to the gradient image.
So this is just the...
You compute the eigenvalues.
Ah, okay.
And you can, this is the essentially orientation of the eigenvector.
Yeah.
The first eigenvector. Yeah, so structure tensor is nice, but it also has some drawbacks. We have this rank one criterion. So you have to think about the sampling theorem. So if you do this Gaussian filtering, you have a global operation, so it's not adapting to local structures. And corner detection using structure tensors has a quite low accuracy. And on the other hand, it's computationally rather complex because you have to really do an eigen decomposition for every pixel in your image. So you end up with doing a lot of eigen decompositions here. If you're interested in this, you can have a book, a look at the book by Jähne, which is interesting. And then the original idea is published in this paper, Edge and Junction Detection with an Improved Structure Tensor, which was presented by on the DAGM. So this is the Deutsche Arbeitsgemeinschaft Mustererkennung. It was used to be called DAGM Symposium, and now it's called GCPR. It's the German Conference on Pattern Recognition. And you can submit in English. Good. Okay, so structure tensor, very useful to detect edges and corners, but the corner detection is maybe not the best, but it's a very nice concept to work with. And now we will expand this concept and we will learn about how to work to apply this to vessels. Because most of, so edges and corners are of course useful, but you can also expand this concept in order to be able to segment vessels. And this is called the vesselness filter. And the vesselness filter has been developed by Frangi, a very nice person. And this vesselness filter is pretty popular. So it has a lot of citations. And this was first presented on Mikai conference. And Mikai conference is exactly the conference where we will have this year's recurrence. So we're not going to the conference, but the Mikai workshop. And this idea was first presented on Mikai. So then you can already get a feeling what kind of people are working there. Very well, vesselness filter. Why would I be interested in a vesselness filter? So vessels, of course, we have a diagnostic interest in vessels, and we want to be able to detect vessels. And vessels have certain properties. First of all, our vessel has two edges. So it has an edge on the left and on the right. Yeah? If you have this, so this is an MR image. This is, by the way, from the original publication. So you have two edges, but you want to detect the vessel here in the very center. And there's another feature of vessels. Vessels have different scales. So you have vessels that are pretty big, and then you have vessels that are very narrow, and you want to design a filter that is able to detect vessels of different sizes. So we somehow have to work with different scales, and we have to work with different. So we have to work with different scales, and we have to work with something else than the structure tensor, because the structure tensor will only give us edges, and we are actually looking for two corresponding edges here in this case. So maybe the structure tensor is not the best idea to model vessels. So what could we do? Well, if you want to detect something, let's say you want to detect a vessel, what you are typically doing is you want, so this is your vessel, and the vessel maybe looks like this. And you want to detect this vessel. Huh? What kind of properties can we see in this vessel? What could be an interesting point to detect this vessel? Yeah, this is intensity. So this is a line through the plot up above. So the nice thing about this vessel here is it has a very nice curvature. So what could be a good detector is something which works on curvature, that detects our curvature maximum here. And now we can essentially take the concept of the structure tensor and not do it with first order derivatives, we're able to detect gradients, but now we want to work with second order derivatives and use it to detect curvature. So this is the general idea, and you can also think about if you have a detector for such a structure and you have a Gaussian, we already know that the first order derivative of the Gaussian looks like this, and now if we have another derivative of this Gaussian, we will end up with something that will first have a high slope, then it will go back to zero again, then we will have a large negative slope, then we go back to zero at this point again. Here we have a zero gradient again, and then we go up again. So we end up with something like this. Have you seen functions like this before? Yeah, so this is a second order derivative of a Gaussian function, and sometimes this is also called the Mexican hat, because if you flip it, it looks like a sombrero, so this is sometimes called Mexican hat function. And if you now think, if you convolve this guy with this kind of vessel structure, you will see that if you have the right size, and you match the essentially the negative slope of your Mexican hat, then, and you convolve this these guys here. So if you convolve this, you will get a very strong negative maximum at this point. So if you convolve this with this, you get a large negative value at this point. And those two wings, they won't play a big role because they are in the uniform intensity area. So you get a strong negative maximum if you do this kind of convolution. Now, based on this, we still have the problem that those vessels have different sizes. Yeah? So we need to be able to build a detector for different sized vessels. Because if I work with this vessel, this kind of standard deviation is optimal. But now I have a vessel that is twice the size, then this detector won't be very well suited for this. And this is why we are introducing something which we call a scale space. I was referring to this earlier without really explaining it, but we are now introducing a scale space. And the scale space is just different versions of the same image with different degree of smoothing. And the idea is the more smoothing I apply, the less local structure will be shown, and the bigger the structures are that I'm able to detect. So I'm constructing the scale space, and now my image suddenly has no longer, so this is a 1D image, and it has the coordinate X and the coordinate S, and S is the scale. So the larger I pick S, the larger will be the structure that I'm detecting. And now I create, I take the original image, I apply different amounts of smoothing, with a centered Gaussian function. And now I can get different versions of the same image, but showing structures of different scale. And then if I want to plug this into a single, framework, I'm using the derivative of Gaussians. So actually I have to perform two derivatives, and I can get a set of adopted filters that have certain scales and compute the second order derivative at the same time. So I can pre-compute those, and then I apply, let's say, 10 times with different discrete scales. I apply 10 times this kind of filtering, and now I have 10 representations of the same image. And of course, I'm going to do this for x and y and xy components, because in the end, I want to build a Hessian. So, So I can do that and compose my derivatives with, again, into the convolution. So I get a set of discrete set of filters, and I will use that later. Now, if I think back of my structure tensor, so rank zero was nice, because with a rank zero structure tensor, we had a flat area. With rank one, we had an edge. And with rank two, we had a corner. But we already said that this is not very useful for vessels, because we always have two corresponding edges, and there's rarely corners. So maybe we want to use curvature. And now we can go back and replace our structure tensor with a Hessian. So we take the Hessian matrix, and this Hessian matrix we compose of different versions of the scaled image. So we have the scaled, so this is the Hessian at scale S, and it operates on the scales of this image. So we have the different scaled versions of the image, and then we compute the derivatives in this scale. And in order to build the Hessian, we need the second order derivative with X and the second order derivative with Y, and of course the mixed components in X and Y. And now we have this Hessian matrix, and we can do again eigenvalue analysis. And the nice thing is this eigenvalue analysis will now tell us something about curvature. So if we have a zero rank, we have no curvature or a flat area. And if we have rank one, we have curvature in one direction. So if you have curvature in one direction in a 2D, so 2D image, yeah? So we have curvature in X direction, but it's constant in the other direction, it's probably a structure that looks like this. Yeah? So we have the curvature along this profile, but we have constant behavior in this direction. And if you have now curvature in both directions, so we essentially need to have this kind of behavior in both directions, we have a structure that more or less looks like this. This is called a blob, because it has this profile in this direction and in this direction. So you have a blob-like structure. And the nice thing now is with this kind of eigenvalue analysis, we have now suddenly something which is detecting vessel-like structures if we have one large eigenvalue. And if we have two large eigenvalues, we are detecting blob-like structures. So we have built essentially a blob detector here. And blob detection often uses this kind of concept. Okay, so now we know we have different eigenvalues for the different scales. And we know that one large eigenvalue is good. And if we had two large eigenvalues, it's probably not a vessel, because it's a kind of blob-like structure. And if we have two low eigenvalues, we will have a more or less flat structure. So we also don't want to do that. But what we still need is we need to combine this into a single detector. So we want to have a detector. And we will first build a detector for each scale. And then we need to add the scales into a single image. OK, how could we do that? Well, this is what Frangi proposes. He is computing two intermediate numbers. He is computing the value, the quantity RB and the quantity S. And now RB is lambda 2 over lambda 1. And we know that lambda 1, the absolute value of lambda 1 must be larger than the absolute value of lambda 2. So if we have a vessel, we will probably have a high lambda 1 and a low lambda 2. So this should be close to 0, this quantity. So RB should be close to 0. If it is close to 1, then we have a blob-like structure. So this is also called the blobness. If RB is close to 1, you have approximately the same values for lambda 1 and lambda 2, and this will be a blob-like structure. If you have two very low eigenvalues, then you also want to be careful about this case. So this is why we also introduce another measure, which is called the structuredness. And this is lambda 1 square plus lambda 2 square and square root. So if you have a high value of S there is generally structure present. If you have a low value of S, it's probably a flat area. Yeah? So if you have low S, it's a flat area. And if you also have high contrast, then you will have a high value of S. Okay, so we want to have RB very small, and we want to have S pretty high. But they will generally be on different scales. So we have to somehow combine them into a single measure. And we can do that by using this simple trick. We build up, first of all, if we have a low value of lambda 1, we are saying, okay, this is not significant anyway, so we put it to 0. And then we combine the blobness and the structuredness into a single measure just by using exponential functions. And the blobness, we expect it to be between 0 and 1. And then we choose a parameter beta, which is, so you can see this is essentially a Gaussian function, but we are missing the scaling factor here. So this is e to the power of minus x squared over 2 sigma squared. This is essentially a Gaussian. And this Gaussian will have its maximum at the position where RB is 0. So if RB squared is 0, we will have the peak of this Gaussian function. And then we have a second Gaussian. And this is now based on S squared. And S squared divided over 2 C squared minus. So this kind of function will have a high value if our S is close to 0. And now we want to have a S should be high, right? So we wanted to have a high S. We wanted to have high values of S and low values of RB. So the first term already fulfills our properties. If we have 0 RB, it will be at the maximum. But the second term here, it would be high for 0 S. So this is why we take 1 minus this term. Then we exactly get the opposite. Yeah? And then we just multiply the two. And this is a kind of probabilistic measure. So we will have outcomes between 0 and 1. And now we have defined a Wesselness measure that will be between 0 and 1. So you can also interpret this as a kind of probability of a Wessel. And this is defined for every scale S. Now what we still need to do is, we have our, let's say, 10 different scales, but we have to fuse them into a single Wesselness image. And we do that by just taking the maximum over all the scales and fuse it into a single image. So we take the maximum probability at this pixel to be a Wessel over all the scales. So this is how we compute the Wesselness image. And then we have a probability map with values between 0 and 1, and this is our Wesselness image. You can further extend that to the 3D case, so if you have volumetric images, and then you have to think about, first of all, you need a 3D Hessian, and now the structures that you're interested in will have the following properties. So you need two directions of curvature, because you're looking for a tube. You're now looking for a tube, and the tube will have two high curvature directions. And it will have one direction without curvature, because this is the flow direction. So we need two high eigenvalues, and then we need one eigenvalue that is close to 0. This will be a good Wessel. And doing so, you can develop 3D Wesselness. So you still have the blobness. Now you define the blobness as lambda 1 times lambda 2, square root, and you divide lambda 3. Then you can have another measure, RA. And this is essentially to detect surface points. So it will be close to 0 if you have a surface point. And then you have, again, this contrast-dependent factor where you just say, okay, I generally want to have large eigenvalues. So if I'm in an area where I don't have large eigenvalues, there's not a good contrast. And now I can, again, assemble those three measures into a single measure of Wesselness, and this is then 3D Wesselness. and we again do the same trick. So we have the structuredness with the 1 minus. We want RB to be close to 0, and we don't want to have cases where RA is close to 0. So this is why we combine it with the minus 1. And just multiply up, and there you go, 3D Wesselness. In order to fuse the different scales, we again apply the maximum operation. And now we have a detector for 3D vessels as a probability map. One way to speed up the implementation is now to use a kind of downsampling, because with increasing scale, we actually can also reduce the number of coefficients to store the image. So if you have a large scale, then you only have low frequencies in the image, and you can get rid of a couple of coefficients. So you do this with a kind of scale-space pyramid, and for the low scales, you keep the full resolution, but for the higher scales, you can then kick out coefficients, and you can do the actual Wesselness computation, the Wesselness measure. You can compute it in a lower dimension, which actually results in the case that you don't have to perform an eigenvalue analysis for every scale and every pixel, but you reduce the number of eigenvalue analysis because you reduce the number of coefficients in the increasing scale levels. So this way you can compute this faster, so you have less eigenvalue analysis and you have faster computation for large images. Okay. So this is the reference to the one thing that I haven't talked about so far is, so this Wesselness measure works very well for cases where you have this vessel. But one case where it typically causes trouble, and there's also plenty of publications how to omit this case, is, so this all works nice until you have a bifurcation. At this point, your Wesselness measure will not work very well. And then typically what you get in your Wesselness detection result is something like this. So you're missing this area because you don't have a good measure of Wesselness at this point. So you have a gap in here. So this is a typical problem of Wesselness, and then people try tracking of vessels in order to complete those bifurcation points. So this is a typical drawback of Wesselness, but there's plenty of ways to get around this. Good. In terms of further literature, there is, of course, the original paper by Frangi. This was Mikai 1998. This idea has been published. And by the way, there's also, I think 2 years ago, there was also a very nice paper by the group from Munich. And the paper was called Frangi Goes US. And it didn't mean that Frangi was actually traveling to the United States, but instead they applied Wesselness filters on ultrasound images, and the paper is called Frangi Goes to US. And the implementation with the scale space Wesselness was published by Attila Budai, an International Journal of Biomedical Imaging. Okay, do you have any questions so far? Yes, plenty.
Has it been tried to have a classifier? So, for example, you could, instead of do the Gaussian thing, you could also train a classifier.
Yes.
Has this been tried?
So there's plenty of the segmentation and structure approaches, and I think there's classifiers also for vessels. So the nice thing with this is you apply basic image processing methods. For the classifier, you then have thousands of options. So you first need to determine features. What kind of features would you take? You probably take edge and curvature features. Yeah? And then you also have to somehow model the dependence on scale. Yeah? So you probably also have to investigate different regions. And if you embed this into a classification approach, in the end, you also get an output probability, probably for the different scales, so you end up with something which is very similar, right?
Yeah, but my question was concretely to use this feature, because you can just have these two numbers, which we compute for every scale, and then scales, and then we can use this as feature. So then we don't have to do this magic maximum. And
well, it's not so much magic.
yeah.
yeah. Yeah. So essentially, if you start classifying, you're going down a segmentation approach. Yeah? But yeah, sure, you can also build classifiers for vessels and then produce those probability maps. One drawback is if you start with a classification, you need training data. So the clear advantage of this is that you have a heuristic method, but you get immediately a result. Then you can probably fix stuff like the bifurcation points, and then you could use that as input for a training method. Yeah. More questions? So, no more questions, then let's conclude today's session. See you next Thursday.
Das ist halt genau. Wir haben